Support for the following program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional funding comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. There's no such thing as free speech, and it's a good thing, too. During this week of July 4th celebrations, that's the word from Stanley Fish, a professor of law and literature at Duke University. I'll talk with Stanley Fish this week on Soundings. When Americans reflect on their national inheritance, free speech is always high on the list of rights that we enshrine. But what is freedom of speech? How's it changed over the course of American history? Stanley Fish is the author of a recent piece published in the Boston Review that he called There's No Such Thing as Free Speech, and It's a Good Thing, Too. I asked him to explain.
Well, the title, of course, is intended to be provocative. The reason I chose it is because in most views of free speech in the First Amendment, the right is thought to be an absolute one, only infringed on in special circumstances, like yelling fire falsely in a crowded theater. Mm-hmm. But my argument is that speech itself only makes sense, only is intelligible, only is meaningful in the context of a desire to argue against something else that might be said by someone else. In other words, what I do is start by asking, what is the purpose of assertion? Why is it that we open our mouths and frame propositions in sentences? And the answer is because you think either that someone else down the street is asserting something incorrectly and you want to correct it, or you think that an important assertion has not been made and the world needs it. What this means to me is that speech is itself always produced under a set of conditions. The pressure to produce speech is a pressure exerted by a point of view, which you either think is being underrepresented or defamed or distorted in some way. Therefore, the idea of free speech, just opening up your mouth to say anything you like, makes no sense whatsoever.
If we look at the history of free speech, Stanley Fish, is this a consensus point of view that you're expressing here? Is this really what the lawyers have known all along and have never really sort of told the public, as it were?
Well, up until, let's say, the early 1950s, I don't know whether it would have been a consensus point of view, but it would have been the stronger point of view. That is, the view of the First Amendment, which makes free speech, quote-unquote, the cornerstone of our democracy and the absolute heart of the American adventure, is a view that's only developed since the 1950s. Before that, the First Amendment was read as one among many competing value statements, so that in a great many cases before the 1950s, First Amendment rights, so-called, were regularly balanced against other rights, rights of society, rights of groups, rights, other rights enumerated in the Constitution, and were often set aside in favor of those rights.
Why the 1950s? What are we talking about, McCarthy? I mean, is there something particular in our culture that came, forces that came together to create those circumstances?
Well, I'm sure that there were, but my own understanding is largely of the legal history. Well, I named the 1950s because of two decisions early in the 1950s, which in a way are the high watermark of the position that I would now revive. One is a decision, the Dennis decision, which upheld a criminal ordinance against certain kinds of organization and distribution of material for the Communist Party. Hmm. And the other was a more interesting case to me called Beauharnais versus Illinois, a 1952 case, which upheld a Chicago ordinance which made group vilification and the dissemination of hate literature a crime. That opinion was written by Justice Frankfurter. And so that as late as 1952, attitudes which are now considered to be frowned on by the First Amendment were approved by the Supreme Court.
Well, let's bring that into the 1990s, Stanley Fish. I mean, one of the things we want to talk about here with regard to free speech is hate speech on campuses mm-hmm. today. Is the problem the words themselves or the ideas behind the words? What is it really that we're getting at when we say that we want to limit free speech to exterminate hate speech on our campuses?
Well, there are various rationales given for speech codes, and some of them I myself cannot sign on to. I don't believe that the institution of speech codes will root out or diminish prejudice. In fact, I'm not sure that anything can do that on a legislative model. It seems to me that for me, the question of speech codes hangs on the question of what we might call public order, or the core rationale of an institution, the reason that people have organized in a particular place to do a particular thing.
Civitas.
Yes, indeed. So that it seems to me that when it becomes the case, or threatens to become the case, that certain forms of speech are so disruptive of normal functionings, that the institution would be, derelict in its duty and obligation if it did not pay some attention to this danger. Now, that attention may not necessarily take the form of speech codes, but I don't think that speech codes should be barred as a matter of so-called principle.
Well, now, this attention is not an absolute phenomenon. This is what we're getting to, finally, that there are limits and we keep pushing these limits?
Well, I think that the limits will vary with the different kinds of institutions. This morning I read in the Raleigh News and Observer that a small Catholic college president has suspended, I think it was, the 33 members of the student newspaper staff because they ran a series of cartoons parodying Catholic arguments about the use of condoms. Mm-hmm. Now, the question one asks then, is this a justifiable act on the part of the president? And I would have to say, look at the nature of the institution, its values, what it stands for, its clientele, its history, its students, etc. And the answer should come out of that rather than out of any absolute rule which pretended that a small Catholic university was the same as Duke University mm-hmm. or the same as Durham Community College or the same as a huge state university like the University of Minnesota.
Is this analogous to what we call community standards? That is to say you can run an X-rated movie in Los Angeles or New York, but you don't want to do it. You know, the old saw about will it play in Peoria?
Yes, yes. I think that the community standards argument is very close to the argument that I would make, especially in relation to universities, given the extraordinary diversity mm-hmm. of institutional educations in our country. I also think it's a pragmatic matter. Were, for example, someone to propose a speech code for Duke University at this moment, I would myself be against it because there is no set of incidents on campus that suggests the need for it, and therefore instituting it would only produce the problems that a code was supposedly established to solve.
Well, let me get this straight, Stanley Fish. My understanding was that you were on record endorsing speech codes, saying we need to ban certain forms of speech.
No, I never endorsed a speech
code. All right, let's get this straight.
I think this is an easy mistake to make. What I am arguing in the various pieces I have read is that the question of to have a speech code or not to have a speech code should not turn on the question of whether or not it's speech and therefore fully protected mm-hmm. under the First Amendment. That simply ignores all of the distinctions that I would want to come into play so that a fully considered decision could be made. My objection is to the invocation of the First Amendment as a means of stopping thought rather than as a means of stimulating thought. So to me, the question of speech code or not speech code is a pragmatic, contingent, in some sense ad hoc question, which administrations and colleges have to face, in a sense, all by themselves.
One of the things that we have here on the table in front of us, Stanley Fish, is an article from a recent Newsweek, a piece about the National Endowment for the Arts. What will be permitted, what will not be permitted, so-called obscenity performance artists. In this interplay between the local, the circumstantial, the universal, which is to say between the interplay between Peoria and our national sensibility, how do we figure out what is going to be acceptable as free speech? Do we always come down as it were, to a local referendum in making policies?
In fact, we always have been coming down to a local referendum when making policies. If you look at the history of First Amendment jurisprudence, it's an attempt over and over again to draw a line separating the protectable forms of speech from the regulatable forms of speech. I say flatly, there is no principled way to draw that line, and therefore the line is always being drawn, even though it's not announced so, the line is always being drawn in terms of local political pressures. Of course, local can refer to a unit as large as the United States or as small as a particular municipality.
Let's look into the future a little bit, Stanley Fish. I'll ask you to make some informed guesses here. The role of the artists, the role of the critics, is to push the edge of the envelope, mm-hmm. deliberately, as it were, to outrage the middle sensibilities, our notions of decorum and what civilization, you know, lots of words for it. Is this, in fact, the case? Is this something that we have to be on guard against? How far do we stretch the limits of free speech?
Well, look, I have a lot of trouble answering any question which begins, what do you think the role of the artist is? Partly because the role of the artist has been so varied. Artists have been propagandists. Artists have been in the hire of governments, of corporations, of noble families, etc. I think that artists do not comprise a unified group, and I resist any effort to draw a halo around the category of art. Let me give you two homely examples. Suppose I were to buy a house, and the house had on its grounds a garden designed by a famous landscape architect, so famous that he was, in effect, in the Landscape Architects Hall of Fame. Mm. And then I buy this house for $400,000 with the grounds, and I look at the grounds, and I see just enough room for a basketball court. And someone says, but it's art. And I say, but I want a basketball court. Or take the case, let's say, screw the case up a bit higher. I buy a house designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. Uh-huh. And I decide that what I really want is some comfortable furniture to sit on rather than the furniture built into Frank Lloyd Wright houses. Unless the house has been made a historical monument, and therefore I would have known beforehand in purchasing it that I was prohibited from changing it, I think I should be allowed to do it. And that people who would yell at me in either instance, but this is art, are in fact professing mysticism without a content.
They're talking about a form of a priesthood here, a sort
That's
of
exactly right.
we're ordaining by categorically we're ordaining a group of people and saying to them it's okay to be rebellious.
And it's also privileging their sensibility above any other concern society might have. You may remember the case of the sculptor, I think his name is Serra, who was commissioned to do a large statue for a federal building in New York. Mm-hmm. And the statue, or the sculpture rather, when it was done, was considered by almost everyone who saw it extraordinarily ugly. And it had this irritating feature. It was designed to rust and flake. So after about a couple of 3 years of complaints, the company, the federal government, decided to dismantle it. Didn't want it any longer and dismantled it, and the sculptor protested. But it's art, he said. And I say, but they bought it, and it's theirs.
It comes down to a commodity again.
Right.
It comes down to, as it were, a consumer choice.
Artists always want to have it both ways. Uh-huh. They want to have, in fact, the benefits of a rarefied commodities market, and they want to be declared above the market, higher than the market, not interested in those Philistine notions. There's a lot of hypocrisy, I think, in what I called art-mongering.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. There's no such thing as free speech, and it's a good thing, too. That's the title of a recent article by Stanley Fish, a professor of law and literature at Duke University. Stanley Fish is my guest this week on Soundings. He's the author of numerous publications about literature and legal culture. His recent work includes a piece that appeared in the Boston Review entitled "There's No Such Thing as Free Speech, and It's a Good Thing, Too." During this week of national celebration, I asked Stanley Fish to describe some of the legal precedents that helped shape his views of free speech and the First Amendment.
Well, two cases come to mind immediately. One is the Falwell versus Hustler case. That's a case in which Larry Flint, the publisher of Hustler magazine, printed a parody interview, supposedly interviewing Falwell, who is telling Hustler magazine about his first sexual experience. And according to the interview, his first sexual experience occurred in an outhouse while he was drunk, and his partner was his mother.
Pretty outrageous.
And it goes on to detail both the sexual urges and the physical unattractiveness of his mother. In very small print at the bottom of the page was labeled parody or ad parody. Mm-hmm. Now, the case went to the Supreme Court, which declared the ad to be gross, repugnant, false, misleading, defamatory, and the result of an intention to cause harm. And then the court took what I take to be the curious turn of saying, nevertheless, because this was speech, it must be protected under the First Amendment because it's a part of the free flow and expression of ideas that is necessary for the health of the Republic.
Isn't there a sort of a perverse logic at work here? What is the logic to that reasoning?
Well, I'm not sure what the logic to the... I assume that the logic to the reasoning is the logic that one often hears in First Amendment decisions of that kind, is that this is the price we must pay to live in a democracy.
Do you believe this is
to
true?
To which I ask often, who is paying this price? Because when the decisions are made, the decisions are made usually not by any of the parties or groups paying the price. A second example of the same kind of reasoning is in a case called American Booksellers versus Hudnut, which is a Seventh Circuit case. This had to do with an Indianapolis ordinance that defined pornography as an act of harm, discrimination, and subordination of women. It's important to note it didn't define pornography as depicting those things, but as, in fact, being those things, simply because of the images it put into the world, which, according to the ordinance, encouraged violence and other hostile acts against women.
And you agree with the decision?
No. The decision of the court, finally, was to invalidate the ordinance. However, before the court gets to that point, the court, in reviewing the arguments on behalf of the audience made by the city of Indianapolis, arguments that said, for example, pornography is not an idea, it is the injury, arguments that equated the effects of pornography with the effects of Nazi propaganda against Jews, etc., the court says, we affirm this position. We agree with this characterization of pornography. And then, just as in the Hustler case,
reverses.
Nevertheless, yeah. Because it's speech, and the First Amendment says you shall not abridge any, the freedom of speech shall not abridge, we must invalidate the ordinance. Now, of course, what I would respond to that is that the reason for the First Amendment's being interpreted as it has been in the last 40 years is a supposed firm distinction between speech and action. But what both of the cases that I've just rehearsed for you show is that the distinction breaks down because, as the court admits in both cases, mm-hmm. the so-called forms of speech are just as effectively and maliciously harmful as action. And therefore, the distinction for which supposedly you maintain a strong First Amendment position is being denied by those very courts that are upholding the supposed distinction. It's zany.
You are coming very close, Stanley Fish, to sounding like the arch enemy of all the liberals, Senator Helms, for example, Representative Army. Tell me about the consistency or inconsistency here.
Well, first of all, I've always considered myself an arch enemy of liberalism, although not in exactly the mode of Senator Helms. So this doesn't come as any surprise to me, although it might come as a surprise to those who have been reading distorted accounts of me in the popular press. I think that Senator Helms and I would agree on the on the relevance of community standards and norms to judgments on art and expression, and then that we would disagree as to what those norms were. So that Senator Helms and I, in particular cases, would probably find ourselves on opposite sides of the question, but we would both agree that the question should be one of the adjudication between the so-called rights, let's say, of artists and the desires, needs, and values of a community.
Stanley, what does it mean to be open-minded? Isn't that a virtue that we should all pursue? We're talking about free speech here.
Certainly one of the people who has objected to my recent article thought so. A professor said, hasn't Professor Fish ever heard of the virtues of an open mind? And I replied in something that I think has now been printed that indeed the open mind would be is not a virtue at all, because if you think about it, an open mind would be a mind not anchored in any firm set of beliefs in relation to which some verbal expressions or opinions would seem horrible or, as Holmes said, fraught with death. An open mind would be a mind without something at one end keeping the things within the mind in some kind of order. An open mind would be a sieve, or an open mind would be an empty mind.
Not to trivialize, but it's like the advice columnist who says to young married people, there are certain things you don't want to say. You can think them and you can believe them about your spouse, but you don't want to say them.
Well, I think that's an excellent example, and I often use the domestic scene, as you know, as an example, because I would say that there is no situation in life of which that couldn't be said, that in this particular context, whether it be a classroom or a medical situation or riding in an elevator or going to the opera or eating in a restaurant or being in a church or synagogue, there are always certain things that you're not going to say, because being a member of that particular situation is indeed defined by not saying those things. And there is no situation that could not, that in which it is possible or desirable or constitutively part of its basic coherence that allows totally free speech. And that's why, as I said earlier, the notion of free speech is an incoherent one.
Should we look at free speech then, Stanley Fish, as a constriction or an opportunity? Mm-hmm. That is to say, when we come to the point in a particular relationship, whether it's a trivial comment that we're making to a colleague or a friend or a spouse, or whether we're defending our beliefs, do we look at free speech as something that constrains us or that opens doors?
I think that we look at free speech as neither. Free speech, I think, should be looked at in the analogy with a free lunch. There is no such thing. And by that I mean you pay for everything. So that in any situation, saying something will have its costs and its benefits. Not saying something will have its costs and its benefits. And the idea that the production of speech is to be unambiguously valued in any circumstances simply ignores this cost benefit calculation, which I believe to be constitutive of all human relationships.
Stanley, I think that you take great delight in putting your adversaries as well as your friends on guard. You do not want to be predictable, do you?
Well, in a way, yes, and in another way, no. As people who have known me for a long time will testify, I've always been conservative, and I consider myself a radical conservative. By that I mean my own views on most matters are taken from four sources: Augustine, Machiavelli, Hobbes, and the writers of some of the Federalist Papers. Now, these are persons who might differ on any number of matters, but they're all joined by a general denial of the perfectibility of man, and therefore they look askance at either Edenic or utopian views of human existence and think in terms of checks and balances, of political necessities, of fighting on the basis of committed faiths, etc. That's always been the position that I have held. And when I was at the University of California in 1962 to 1974, I was known on campus to be one of the more conservative people on campus.
You've been accused, too, of being a relativist, that is to say, and therefore a destroyer of values, a questioner of what is fundamental, a denier of truth with a capital T. What about that?
Well, that accusation has been made by people who have never read my work, in which I've, in fact, mounted attacks on relativism over and over again. not as relativism, as a philosophical position which you identify yourself as taking by answering certain questions, like where do you think facts come from, or are truths revisable? But being a relativist in that sense doesn't mean that you could be a relativist in the sense that I am sometimes accused of being one, that is, of holding in an indifferent mix my views and convictions, let's say, in relation to the views and convictions of others. Not only am I not that kind of relativist, it's my thesis that no one could be that kind of relativist. And that's for the same reason that I gave a few moments ago
when we were talking about
the open mind.
Wouldn't have an anchor.
That's right. To be a relativist in the sense of which I'm accused is to have a mind that is like a sieve with nothing in it. I have some answers to traditional questions in philosophy which rank me on the relativism side rather than on the foundationalist side. But in no way does that make me, nor could it make me, a relativism. Relativism is not a possible mode of being for any human.
Stanley, when are you going to run for office?
I ran for office when I was a freshman in college and was elected. I was secretary of my freshman class. The last time I was put up for office was earlier this year for the presidency, or rather the second vice presidency of the MLA, a position which then ascends to the presidency. But I was, in fact, not elected. So that, I guess, over the years, what we now think of as my electability quotient has been declining.
Stanley Fish, always a pleasure to have you at the National Humanities Center and hear you have you turn up on Soundings. Your books include Doing What Comes Naturally. You teach literature and law at Duke University. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to a conversation with Stanley Fish, a professor of law and literature at Duke University. During a recent residency at the National Humanities Center, Stanley Fish worked on a project about the First Amendment. His most recent book is Doing What Comes Naturally, a collection of essays available from Duke University Press. This program is available on cassette. For a copy, please send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 614. That's program number 614, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, technology, old and new. Join me for conversations with Henry Binford of Northwestern University and George Houston of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Henry Binford will discuss the history of ice cream. George Houston will talk about telling time in ancient Roman culture. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center.
Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
There's no such thing as free speech, and it's a good thing, too. This week on Soundings, I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for Stanley Fish, a professor of law and literature at Duke University. Is there such a thing as free speech? How has it changed over the course of American history? Stanley Fish says there is no such thing as free speech, and it's a good thing, too. Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.